Lecture 12, Greek Myth, Etruscan Homes.
The Greek historian Diodorus Siculus wrote of the Etruscans that they surpassed the other barbarians, that is, non-Greeks, in the extravagance of their way of life. And indeed, looking at the evidence, ancient artifacts and collections of images that we have from Etruscan society, we see that he has a point. The evidence displays an emphasis on family, children, and romantic love, along with a surprising number of images of grooming, banqueting, and dancing. But rather than view such mannered customs of the Etruscans as self-indulgent, as so many scholars, including Diodorus, have done, we might better see them as outlets for declaring identity. The Greeks would declare such identity through public dedications, such as statues of athletes found in their great sanctuaries. The Etruscan world had different values. For instance, in their emphasis on family, children, and romantic love, we need to remember that for the Etruscans, women seem to have had a status almost equal to men, or at least that wives and husbands were very equal. A Greek, such as Diodorus, would not have encountered that in his world and might not have even understood it, thus his moralizing conclusion on extravagance. In contrast, the Etruscans were familiar with the Greek world and borrowed from it all sorts of cultural customs, including the stories and images of Greek myth. And these myths became the most popular decorative elements in the Etruscan domestic sphere, found on furniture, pottery, and personal belongings. In this context, through the lens of the particular Greek myths that the Etruscans selected, and how they were altered for their own purposes, and how they chose to display them, all of this reveals something significant about the times, about their personal tastes, and cultural values. And it remains visible today. Before we begin looking at specific examples, it's important to establish some basic suppositions. First, we conclude that Etruscan artists, patrons, and the audiences for the images of Greek myth used in the home had a more than passing familiarity with Greek deities and hero myths. These two categories were often transmitted in very different media or genres or of art or literature. It's clear that the Etruscans must have had a sophisticated understanding of the literary and figural traditions alike that were imported from the Greek world. The Etruscans frequently borrowed Greek cultural references that were somewhat obscure, even in Greek culture, which makes it certain that the Etruscans were not just copying the most common works of the time. Moreover, the lack of captions on many such images of myth demonstrates the expectation that the Etruscan audience for which they were intended wouldn't have needed help to understand the underlying story. Let's start with a very early example of what would eventually become one of the most popular Greek myths in Greek and Etruscan art, the Cyclops and Scylla episodes from Homer's Odyssey. The Etruscans, because of their extensive trade networks, were a conduit for foreign influences into their native lands in modern-day Italy, from alphabetic writing to Greek mythology. An early image of these monsters was found carved on an ivory cylindrical box called a pyxis in Greek, which was found in a grave in a necropolis at Cusae, one of the most powerful Etruscan cities, centrally located in Etruria between Orvieto to the south and Arezzo to the north. The carving dates to the orientalizing phase in Etruscan art, that is 700 to 600 BC, which saw the earliest introduction of Greek subjects and Near Eastern influence into the art of the Italian peninsula. Unlike the Assyrian-inspired designs on other contemporary art, Its designs and figures rely directly on Greek models and show an awareness of Greek literature, specifically Homer's Odyssey. This Pyxis was created in about 620 BC, almost exactly 100 years after the Odyssey was written. The Pyxis is divided into four long horizontal figural bands called registers, separated by narrow borders of vine work derived from Corinthian painted pottery. The figures in the registers are carved in relief in a style that lines them up so they can all be clearly identified, with very little overlapping and disproportionately large heads on squat bodies. In addition to figures of animals and monsters, two of the registers are filled with scenes from Homer's Odyssey, with the escapes of Odysseus and his men from the Cyclops, Polyphemus, and the monster Scylla, clearly represented. The representations of the adventures of Odysseus and his men demonstrate the importance of Greek myth in Etruscan art, which will come to dominate the sculptural and painted work of Etruscan artists. The figural registers also exemplify the introduction of Greek narrative techniques into Etruscan art, as the story is told by lines of figures divided by bands in an episodic narrative technique. The prominent ship in the upper register may supply some indication of the reason for the popularity of this story and its spread throughout ancient Italy in the 7th century BC. Because this is the time of colonization, and naval exploration, and expanding international trade between Etruscans, Greeks, and Phoenicians around the Italian peninsula. Another factor in the popularity of these specific episodes might have been the geography of the Odyssey, which placed Scylla and the Cyclops off the west coast of Italy, in the branch of the Mediterranean Sea the Greeks called the Tyrrhenian, their word for Etruscan. The Etruscan artists, displaying an ability with carving ivory, a precious, rare, imported material that is impressive, but does not match their long tradition with metalwork. The Etruscans and central Italians of antiquity were masters at a range of metalworking and decorating techniques, including hollow and solid casting and the engraving of bronze. Their techniques were used to create complex figural works of great sophistication, including complex engraved scenes on bronze hand mirrors. Bronze hand mirrors were among the most common personal possessions of Etruscan women. They were owned by all but the very poorest women and were popular wedding gifts. We often find them in tombs with cosmetic sets or jewelry, which emphasized their role in celebrating or ensuring female adornment and beauty. Elaborate dress and jewelry was an element of elite female identity. These handheld mirrors were solid cast pieces consisting of a circular mirror 6 or 7 inches in diameter with an attached handle measuring from 4 to 7 inches in length. The bronze mirror head was highly polished on one face as a reflective surface, while the other was decorated, usually with a mythological scene that was engraved or, on occasion, cast as part of the mirror. Their engraved backs reveal Etruscan use and adaptation of Greek myths on the accessories that help to establish elite female identity. We're also fortunate to have found and preserved many small personal effects of Etruscan men, women, and families, including cistae, or containers, that held cosmetics and jewelry. The Ficaroni cista is easily one of the finest. Excavated at the town of Praeneste, about 21 miles east of Rome, it was one of 118 cistae, round bronze containers that held cosmetics, jewelry, and other items for female adornment, found in tombs in that city alone. The technical complexity of the Ficaroni cista is surprising. In addition to shaping the round form of the bronze container, it was engraved. Handles were cast separately and attached to it in the final step. Notably, the maker inscribed the work and identified it as having been fashioned in Rome. The inscription on the handle reads, Novius Plautius Romae med fecit Dindia Malconia filii dedit, which means, Novius Plautius made me in Rome, Dindia Malconia gave me to her daughter. The Ficarone Sista is the earliest surviving work of Roman art owned and perhaps commissioned by a woman. How it made its way from Rome to Praeneste is, and probably always will be, a mystery. This is rare and critical evidence for the high level of these forms made by artists at Rome in the Etruscan bronze industry in the 4th century BC. It also shows the spread of Greek myths and the association of this form with Etruscan women. The exterior body of the Sista is covered with a detailed engraving of 19 figures in a fully realized landscape in a single scene that wraps around the entire vessel. The full height of the field is utilized as figures sit, stand, or recline in the landscape, encouraging the eye to move, taking in the entire image. The proportions, composition, and style of the figures exemplify knowledge of contemporary late classical Greek motifs and artistic conventions, particularly those known from landscape painting and relief sculpture. The figures are viewed from a variety of perspectives. Each one is a unique image of the nude human male form, as its artisan creator, Novius Plautius, displayed his mastery of contemporary standards of Greek art. The scene tells one episode in the story of the Argonauts, the heroes who accompanied Jason on his quest for the Golden Fleece. Amycus challenged anyone to a boxing match who wanted to get water from his spring. Pollux accepted the challenge and beat him so that the other Argonauts could drink. In the story the scene relates, Pollux ties the defeated Amycus to a tree as Minerva and Hercules look on. The rest of the Argonauts are resting, with Pollux's twin brother Castor training in his punching bag. None of the figures is labeled in either Greek or Etruscan. That left it to the viewer to recognize the event and leads us to the assumption that they would have been able to. They may have recognized the source from the image as well. Some scholars conclude that the engravings on the Ficarone Sista reproduce a lost 5th century BC painting by Mycon, commissioned for a sanctuary in Athens and known from descriptions by the author Pausanias. Interesting digression. Well, I think it's interesting. We actually have Mycon's home and workshop. They were discovered in Athens. I discussed the site in another course on cities of the ancient world. Well, the narrative moment the Sista depicts is the post-climactic one, after the match is over. Therefore, we're left to concentrate our attention on Pollux's victory rather than on the struggle to achieve it. Another 4th century BC Sista was found in a tomb at Praeneste. Its exterior was decorated with a scene from Greek myth. This Sista breaks the pattern in Etruscan art of depicting different myths in scenes reserved, on the one hand, for domestic matters, and elsewhere for sacred ones. The mythological episodes found on domestic objects rarely show graphic scenes of death or bloodshed as found on material from tombs and sanctuaries. I think that distinction is based on the differing context and especially audience for each category of artworks. The Sista uncovered at the Praeneste tomb is engraved with a version of Achilles sacrificing his Trojan prisoners during the Trojan War. The scene that was one of the two most prominent wall paintings in the Francois tomb at Vulci. The subject raises the possibility that the Sista was made to be placed in the tomb, not just placed there as a cherished personal possession that the deceased owned in life. Therefore, it was decorated with an appropriately funereal image of blood sacrifice, commonly found in Etruscan tombs. Homer describes the culmination of the funeral of Patroclus, in whose honor Achilles sacrificed the Trojans. King Agamemnon, hearing this, promptly dismissed the men to their well-crafted ships, though the chief mourners remain, and piling up the wood to make a pyre 100 feet square, sad at heart, they placed the corpse on top. They flayed and dressed numerous fine sheep and sleek, shambling cattle before the pyre, and noble Achilles took fat from them all and wrapped the corpse in it, head to foot, and piled the flayed carcasses around. Then he leant 2-handled jars of oil and honey against the bier, and groaning aloud, swiftly threw the bodies of 4 proud horses on the pyre. Of the 9 dogs Patroclus fed beneath his table, Achilles cut the throats of 2 and threw their bodies on the pyre. Then he completed the grim task he had in mind, killing 12 noble sons of the brave Trojans with this bronze blade and setting the pyre alight so the pitiless flames would spread. Unlike the vast majority of mirror engravers, the engraver of the cista at the Praeneste tomb did not label his figures, yet we readily identify by dress and pose which of the men are Greek and which are Trojan prisoners. Overseeing Achilles' sacrifice of his Trojan prisoners is the armed and armored goddess Athena, known to the Etruscans as Minerva. Her inclusion may be based on her popularity in the Etruscan world. It certainly is not an element of the scene described by Homer. This engraving also includes the Etruscan underworld demon Vanth, leaning apparently casually against a rock, with her legs crossed, waiting to lead the dead Trojan soldiers' souls into Hades. She's one of the figures inserted into the same scene in the Francois tomb. In the scene where the Trojan soldiers are being slaughtered, preparations for a fire have been made to burn their bodies. The details of this pyre do not match Homer's account, however. The bier in front of which Achilles slaughters the first Trojan prisoner is decorated not with the animal sacrifices described in the Iliad, but with 2 shields and a breastplate. This variation echoes the display of shields and armor found in Etruscan tombs, such as the 4th century BC Tomb of the Reliefs at Cerveteri. Standing before the pyre, Achilles slits the throat of 1 prisoner while others, with their hands bound and their legs cut and bleeding so they can't run away, stand by awaiting their fate. These myths of the Argonauts and Achilles in the Trojan War were certainly all heroic episodes, but terribly dark stories for what used to be referred to as toilet articles, mirrors, jewelry boxes, cups, and such. There's something of anomalies compared to the typical imagery of Greek myths found on domestic objects. The vast majority of the Greek myth scenes on these items are more pleasant. The most popular is the Judgment of Paris. This is the event, as much as any, that can be said to have caused the Trojan War, and depictions of it are very popular in literature and art. The story goes something like this. The goddess Discord, uninvited to the wedding of Peleus and Thetis, threw a golden apple marked "for the fairest" into the wedding reception. Athena, Aphrodite, and Hera all claimed it and asked Zeus to decide which of them was entitled to a prize reserved for the fairest. Wise enough not to judge a beauty contest between 3 members of his own family, Zeus selected as judge the Trojan prince Paris. The typical Etruscan representation of the subject shows Paris and the 3 goddesses. Sometimes they're accompanied by Hermes, the messenger of the gods, who set up the contest. The competing goddesses are frequently distinguished by individual attributes. Athena wears a helmet. Hera has her head covered by her cloak, as is fitting for a married woman, or she wears a crown. Aphrodite often carries a mirror. And that latter detail might suggest why this scene is so popular on domestic objects. It illustrates a famous event in the myths of Aphrodite, the goddess of love and beauty, whose attribute of a mirror connects her to the woman who owned a mirror with this scene on it. From among the goddesses and their bribes, this was not a fair beauty contest, Paris selected Aphrodite, who had bribed him with the promise of the most beautiful woman in the world, Helen of Greece. Consequently, Paris is usually portrayed handing the apple to Aphrodite, indicating her victory. The impetus for the Greek invasion and 10-year Trojan War is the abduction of Helen from Greece to Paris's city of Troy. The iconography of the Judgment of Paris makes it very identifiable. Generally, however, the figures are labeled with Etruscan names rather than Greek ones. Uni for Hera, Minerva for Athena, Turin for Aphrodite, and El Concentor for Paris, apparently based on his alternate name, Alexander. In contrast to the Greek version of the myth, in the Etruscan version, Turin or Aphrodite does not stop with offering Helen, Elena in Etruscan, to Paris. The Etruscan mirrors and cistae include many images of Turin guiding the relationship between Ilinae, or Helen, and El Concentor, that is, Paris. In sum, she seems to operate as an advocate for El Concentor, apparently by introducing the couple. In another, Turin, that is, Aphrodite, witnesses the birth of their child, showing her nurturing aspect, which was missing in Greek myth and art. When the Greeks finally break into Troy, Ilinae, or Helen, seeks sanctuary at the Temple of Minerva, while El Concentor, Paris, seeks asylum on an altar. In representations of these two scenes, Turin, Aphrodite, interposes herself between each of them and the Greeks who would harm them. In fact, stories of love and romance are common in domestic art, especially on bronze mirrors. Even the myths of Hercules, known by the Etruscans as Hercule, have romantic Etruscan variations. Famous for his strength and for his violent adventures, Hercules, we are told, had a love affair with an Etruscan goddess named Molokuk. On one mirror, Hercules' bow and quiver of arrows lay discarded on the ground as he picks up Molokuk in the standard abduction pose, although she's not struggling against the hero. Hercules has symbolically, well, literally, laid aside his weapons and his warlike nature and taken up romance, or its nearest equivalent. In addition to this rather uncharacteristic side of his personality, Hercules and Minerva sometimes appear on Etruscan mirrors caring for infants, usually the ambiguous semi-divine figures who are named Maris. In doing so, Helen and Minerva demonstrate paternal and maternal qualities that are important to the Etruscans, especially in these domestic contexts, and which are not found in the canonical Greek myths. Speaking of children, birth stories from Greek myth also make their appearance on Etruscan mirrors in unusual, non-canonical forms. For example, the Etruscans seem to have been fond of the account of Helen of Troy's birth. Zeus, in the form of a swan, seduced her mother, Leda. So, as you might expect, she laid an egg containing Helen rather than giving birth to to a human infant. Versions of the story are found on many mirrors, with all the principal figures labeled in the Etruscan language, as is typical for the medium. It might be that the Judgment of Paris scenes weren't considered by the Etruscans as images of the Trojan War, but as one episode in the story of Helen. Her life seems to have been more popular on bronze mirrors than were the Trojan War stories. Examples include images of Helen's birth, Helen and the Trojan prince Paris, Alexander, and Paris and her husband Menelaus, Menelaus in Etruscan, or with some combination, along with the goddess of love Aphrodite, Turin. Another significant Greek mythological birth, and one of the most frequently illustrated ones in Etruscan domestic art, was the birth of Athena out of the head of Zeus. According to Greek mythology, Athena burst fully grown from the head of Zeus, armed and armored, as the result of Zeus swallowing her pregnant mother, Metis, goddess of wisdom. In this way, Zeus gained wisdom and the experience of childbirth. If you've given birth or even witnessed it, it might comfort you to know that Zeus's experience was probably worse. The Greek god Hephaestus, who split Zeus's skull with an axe as a treatment for Zeus's complaint of a headache, also assisted in the delivery of Athena, as sort of midwife. Say whatever bad things you want about our medical system, I think things have come a long way since then. Well, the love affair of Turin and Atunus was also a very popular subject for mirror engravers. Many surviving mirrors from this time are decorated with scenes of the pair locked in a romantic embrace. In Greek myth, Adonis, known to the Etruscans as Atunus, was the first mortal lover that Aphrodite took, and she was deeply smitten with the young man of almost divine good looks. However, their love, and you probably saw this coming, was doomed by his mortality. He was killed in a hunting accident, gored by a wild boar, and Aphrodite was powerless to save him. Doomed love is very romantic. It's also interestingly parallel to the images of fated death that we find in tombs. The loving couple on these mirrors might seem destined for a successful love affair, but any Etruscan who saw it would have known the end of the story. Turin, or Aphrodite, is the subject of a number of representations in which she appears without her lover Atunus or Adonis, but she's never alone. Instead, she has a group of attendants called the Circle of Turin, which encompasses as many as 16 other divine figures. In most instances, they act as her attendants, helping her to dress, bejewel herself, and generally make herself more attractive, rather by arranging her hair, tying on ribbons, adjusting her diadem, or adding bracelets to her jewelry. Sometimes they assist Atunus in his appearance as well. This is definitely an Etruscan variation on the Aphrodite myths, and it's a very culturally significant one in ancient Italy. Later in the Roman world, being seen was a significant means of establishing and retaining status. And one way to do that was through one's attendants. An elite Roman was never alone, and the more elite, the more retainers. Yes, that includes at home during intimate encounters. Attendants were expected. I think that this variation in the myths of Turin or Aphrodite, records the Etruscan perspective on status and demonstrates that it applies to women as well as men. Roman women were publicly invisible until the time of the Emperor Augustus, whereas Etruscan women were not. The concept of a circle of attendants is another Etruscan idea passed along to the Romans. The topics of dress, adornment, love, and attendance lead us to a particular subset on the Turin mirror images. In this smaller selection, Turin is indeed only one of the attendants. She takes a supporting role rather than a central one. And the entire subject demonstrates the Etruscan genius at manipulating Greek myth. These mirrors show the adornment of a female figure labeled Malavish, who is the personification of marriage. Although Malavish appears on other mirrors in the assembly of the gods, along with Greek deities such as Apollo and Artemis, here she's the focus. Typically, she's seated in a throne-like chair with a footstool, while other figures dress her hair, apply jewelry, or generally adorn her. Some mirrors depict only two attendants. Others include images of oracular deities such as Apollo, or prophets such as a disembodied head that apparently prophesied the success of the marriage. One of the finest examples of these decorated mirrors shows three attendants working on Malavish's appearance simultaneously, overseen by Turin, who is apparently present as a personification of romantic love. The three attendants are named Zipna, Hinthiol, and Muthok. Hinthiol, Sol, holds the mirror that's used to read the prophecy of the upcoming marriage. So love, Turin, is overseeing beauty, Zipna, Sol, Hinthiol, and elegance, Muthok, making preparations for a successful match by attending to Malavish, marriage, on a mirror given as a wedding gift and used by an Etruscan woman to help dress her own hair and to apply makeup or jewelry to ensure her own successful marriage. I can't think of a better example of the application of myth to support the values of Etruscan society.